Good afternoon, and welcome to this week's Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, the play's the thing. Once again, as we highlight some of the terrific local theater offerings, how lucky we are to have such interesting spaces as Z Below, The Cutting Ball, and The Marsh as part of our cultural landscape here in the Bay Area. Folks involved in productions in all three of those venues will be here with us today. Liberty Bradford Mitchell, daughter of Artie Mitchell of San Francisco's infamous Mitchell Brothers, tells the story of growing up on the fringes of an X-rated world in the world premiere of her The Pornographer's Daughter, now being produced at Z Below. She'll be joined by director Michael T. Weiss. The director-thespian pairing of guests continues with director Yuri Ernoff and actor David Sanayko, who will share details about The Cutting Ball's production of Alfred Jarry's Ubu Ra, a parody of Shakespeare's Macbeth that shocked audiences at its premiere in 1896. And award-winning actor Brian Copeland will be in to talk about the world premiere of The Scion at The Marsh, a tale of privilege, murder, and sausage. It's his fourth solo show. And no, it's not intentional that all of the dramas on today's show involve murder in some way, shape, or form. Plus, local musician Matt Montgomery will be by to share details about a special concert he's in with the Awesome Orchestra this Sunday in Oakland. So stay tuned. There is perhaps no play in recorded history with a more infamous opening night than Ubu Ra. At one point, the pandemonium so intense that the actors simply stopped to watch the audience. Cutting Ball Theater's presents Alfred Jarry's Ubu Ra in a new translation by Rob Melrose, directed by Russian director Yuri Ernoff, and starring David Sanayko, both of whom join me in studio to share details about this fascinating play. Actor David Sanayko is an associate artist at Cutting Ball who has appeared in more than a dozen of the company's productions, including recently Crispy Critters in The Scarlet Night, The Chairs, The Strindberg Cycle, and many others. He's also been in the popular Bay Area one-man production of David Sedaris's Santaland Diaries. Welcome, David, back to the airwaves of KALW.
Hi, David.
Director Yuri Ernoff makes his Cutting Ball debut with Ubu Ra. He's directed over 40 productions in his home country, Europe, and Africa. In Russia, he translated and directed the national premieres of Martin McDonagh's fascinating The Lieutenant of Inishmore and Sarah Ruhl's Dead Man's Cell Phone. He's also brought over 20 contemporary Russian plays to America by collaborating with New Russian Dramas Play Translation Production and Conference called the Center for International Theater. And Yuri also joins me in studio. Yuri, welcome to KALW.
Thank you. Hi.
Well, this play had a fascinating opening. I'm wondering if you could share with us the first word that made those Parisian audiences break into a riot in 1896. And remember, this is family radio.
Well, that's Thursday in English, right?
Yeah, indeed. David Sanayko?
Well, I can't do the first word in English in a family radio station, but I can say it in French, I think, which is merde.
But it is pronounced slightly differently and intentionally differently in that.
Jarry added a little R onto the end of the word merde, which hopefully our listeners have some sense of what that means in English.
Uh-huh. And let's just say poopy.
Poopy, yeah.
You said that on the air, I think.
So the lead character comes out, and the first word he says is merde. And as legend has it, and many eyewitnesses report, it immediately started the audience shouting, either in favor of or against the play. They calmed everyone down and continued with the play. And I think 10 or 15 minutes later, the audience started shouting back at the stage again, and it turned into, by all reports, a full-scale riot. People throwing chairs, shouting at each other, and they finally had to stop the play.
Fascinating. Now, give us somewhat of a synopsis. We heard about the opening, but what is the play about?
So what's, I think, pretty interesting about the play is if you go to the Wikipedia page for Ubu Hua and look at their synopsis, it's very poorly written. And the reason it's poorly written is because it's almost impossible to synopsize the play. It incorporates a lot of inspiration from Shakespeare's Macbeth, and it's got some Lear sprinkled in there, some Hamlet, really a lot of Shakespearean influence in the play. It's a five-act structure like Shakespeare's plays were. And I think the best description so far I've heard was from Rob Melrose, who's the artistic director of Cutting Ball and translated the play, is that it's a very fascinating and sort of forced combination of very low and very high art, kind of all squeezed together. Essentially, though, it's about a man who wants to have everything right now.
This is your character, Father Ubu.
Father Ubu, yes. And he goes about getting everything he wants through very crude methods. The general synopsis of the play is he wants to become the king of Poland. So along conspiring with his wife, he sets about becoming the king by killing the current king and starting a coup and a revolution. And once he has the crown on his head, he proceeds to kill all the nobles. He kills all the judges. He kills all the financiers and starts a war with Russia. And then he goes to war with Russia, and I don't want to tell the end.
Well, you know how he ends. You know, when you start the war with Russia, you know how he ends.
That's Yuri Ernov, who is here, Russian, Moscow-born, director making his debut at the Cutting Ball in this production of Ubu Hua. So, Yuri, tell us a little bit what it's like working with American actors versus Russian actors.
It's a great experience, obviously, and
good answer, right?
Yeah, yeah. Next question.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What we discussed earlier.
Right.
Your contract is hereby renewed. Congratulations. Okay. You're coming back to the Cutting Ball next season.
The great thing about the play is that, you know, it's all about breaking rules, and Jari is breaking all the possible rules in his drama, and his main character is breaking all the possible rules in his life. So we are also trying to break all the possible theatrical rules as we go and work on the piece. And from that perspective, I had a lot of fun with breaking all the possible rules with these actors. I think it felt very good through the process. We still keep breaking them.
Well, that interesting you should mention breaking the rules. I'm wondering, as a director, how much of Jari's rules you can break. He requested that Ubu be played with a mask, that the actor should speak in an affected voice, that Ubu's horse should be made of cardboard. How much do you have to adhere to Jari's original description?
I think we're trying to be as free or as liberated as Jari was. We're taking his, as he's playing with the drama, the same way I think we're trying to play with his play. So we're doing whatever we want with his play, I believe. So we're breaking not just general rules that he establishes.
And I'm wondering how that's allowed, because I know in the musical theater world, you can't alter a lyric. You can't add your own dialogue in between scenes. They're very strict things you have to adhere to.
Here's one good thing about dead authors, you know?
I understand that role. Okay.
I mean, Samuel Beckett has a foundation, an estate that looks after his work, and they're extremely strict about the way you interpret Beckett's work, to the point where if you do it in a way they don't want you to do it, they can essentially ban you from ever getting the rights to any of his plays.
Well, it's like Tams Whitmark and the Gershwin Estates as well.
Not a problem with Jari. Mm-hmm. Not at all. And he was a very, very interesting iconoclastic character himself as an artist, and he hung out with a lot of the very famous avant-garde artists of his time. And in fact, at that first production where the first rule got broken and it started a riot, there were a lot of luminaries in the audience, including William Butler Yeats, who after witnessing this riot at the production, went back and wrote a long sort of screed about his experience, which ended with, after this, what? The savage God? And I think he was right. I mean, I think he really witnessed something Yeats did about Jarry's work and about Ubuhua as a play and as a statement, as a gesture, an artistic gesture that was terrifying in a certain way, because there was no formalism. There were no rules, essentially.
And I mean, he's writing, his play is a provocation for the theater itself. You know, I think he's proposing you to break all the possible rules, because he tells, you know, bring the whole Russian army on stage and then bring the whole Polish army on stage and just go do it.
And also, I've seen the stage at Cutting Ball. That's not going to happen, is it?
Yeah, yes, it will. Certainly, we are bringing all these guys.
You got to come see. It's unbelievable.
And actually, an actor will be portraying one of the armies, right?
We're not saying this. Probably the fruit. More like the fruit will be portraying one of the armies.
It does. Our production does take place entirely in a very beautiful upscale kitchen.
He did indicate that people should be in contemporary dress and all that. So
yeah, it's all contemporary dress, and the kitchen of these people's home becomes the battlefield in Russia and Poland.
I think I have an idea of what's coming next.
A cave, and it's everything.
Yeah, I think people in the audience should also dress appropriately, because we're smashing a lot of fruit. So those sitting in the first row, beware.
It's going to be a riot.
We also have sausages. Somebody mentioned sausages earlier. We have murders and sausages.
Yeah, that's coming in our next segment.
Yeah, we have sausage too. So third segment. Brian, just come see our show. We had sausage too.
That's actor David Sinaiko. He's here with Yuri Ernov talking about the Cutting Ball production of Alfred Jarry's Ubuhua, sure to be a good time for all. Now, Yuri, you've done quite a bit of work translating English plays into Russian. So is the phrase lost in translation apply when you get something that's as visual and as word intense as Lieutenant of Inishmore of Martin McDonagh?
I think we did a pretty good job with this specific one, with this specific play. And I think it's not just language, it's, you know, the mentality. And there is something about this Irish-like mentality that I think is pretty close to Russian one. So that was actually a very easy connection over there. It's much bigger work with Sarah Rule's work, or with Albee's work, actually, another thing I was translating.
Well, I was just going to say that Rob Melrose really has done a wonderful job of finding the balance between using as much literal translation as he can, but also adapting euphemisms and vernacular phrases in a way that sort of makes sense. I mean, Jarry didn't try very hard to make sense. It wasn't his main motive to make sense. And Rob has really done, I think, a wonderful job doing that with this production, keeping it in a way accessible to the audience, but also keeping the spirit of Jarry's insistence that it not be good dialogue, it not be good, and I'm putting air quotes up for those of you in the radio audience.
You can tap the microphone for that.
Theater.
Yeah, air quotes. Right.
Yeah. So he it's a fascinating thing, translation, how you make the choices when it comes down to choosing an image that is either going to be a literal translation of what the author wrote, or something that's going to be more viscerally accepted by the audience for whom the translation is intended.
And I think you really managed to translate the meaning, because you're not translating the words. You're trying to translate the meaning of the thing. And I think you did a great job on this.
Neat. David, you're involved with a lot of contemporary works at Cutting Ball and elsewhere, but also some of the wonderful classics like The Tempest. Do you have a preference for something of the more contemporary or absurdist or Shakespearean? What's your next project after this?
After this, I'm actually moving over to the Shotgun to work on their Coast of Utopia cycle that they're doing. I think I love it all, and I really think that Cutting Ball has a lovely niche that it's carved out for itself in San Francisco, in both taking classic plays, revisioning them, reimagining them in a contemporary way, and also classics of the avant-garde or modern theater like The Chairs. We've done a lot of Ionesco, who's just a wonderful playwright to work with, and all the way up to Andrew Saito's Crispy Critters in The Scarlet Night, and we're going to be seeing more of Andrew's work at Cutting Ball in the seasons to come. They all pose particular challenges. I think doing a classic like The Tempest, Shakespeare, or the Strindberg Cycle, all the way up to a classic like Ubu Hua, which is a classic in its own really odd way, each one of those presents a great opportunity and a privilege to be able to say those words that have continued to resonate throughout the history of theater and our culture.
And so, also, I mean, it does feel, Ubu feels so much more contemporary than many contemporary plays today. It feels like two centuries ahead. We're still in the world before Ubu in the theater very much.
So everything still applies, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's Yuri Ernov. I wish you a wonderful debut here in San Francisco. We hope you're back for some more.
Do my best. Thank you.
David Sinaiko, an excellent run to you for Ubu Roi.
Thank you.
It's at the Cutting Ball Theater. Information at cuttingball.com. It runs through February 23rd. Gentlemen, thanks for taking some time today.
So very nice to be here. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's music from the Fluffers, which will be providing some of the background music for my next guest's solo show, The Pornographer's Daughter. Artie and Jim Mitchell comprised one of San Francisco's most infamous duos, the Mitchell Brothers, pioneers in the pornography industry. Liberty Bradford Mitchell, daughter of Artie, tells the story of growing up on the fringes of an X-rated world and of learning of the death of her father by the hand of her uncle, when she was living in L.A. Liberty and Michael join me, and Michael T. Weiss, the director of the production, joins me here in studio to talk about the play at Z Below, which will have musical accompaniment live by the Fluffers. Michael T. Weiss, Liberty Bradford
Hello.
Mitchell, welcome to KALW.
Thanks
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Liberty, quite a story that you've gone through and processed as an adult, but tell us a little bit about your dad.
My dad was a very vibrant character, and you know, growing up, I knew that he definitely had a presence in San Francisco, and it was difficult to wrap my head around the industry he was in once I became old enough to realize that being a pornographer would make eyebrows raise and perhaps make play dates a little bit harder to arrange. But my dad was a very charismatic person. He had a real infectious energy and had just slews of people who loved and admired him. But, you know, he was also, like all of us, a flawed human being and had his demons that he was grappling with at the end of his life.
Well, let's mention the earlier part of his life where you mention in your writing that he put the fun in dysfunction as far as your family is concerned.
Yes. He was a very colorful character, and I know that that's been passed down to all of my siblings and myself. He wasn't afraid to live out loud, that's for sure. And I do attribute a lot of my bravery to go forward with this work and the lessons that, you know, the best part of what he shared with me, of just knowing you can do anything if you really want to, and just having that faith in oneself and not being afraid to have a vision that's way bigger than what a lot of other people can comprehend.
Well, you were already down in L.A. going to school, I guess, when you learned of your father's death at the hand of your uncle. How did you learn about this, the event?
I got a phone call at 5:30 in the morning from my mother with the news. So, and I had just been in San Francisco the weekend before trying to compel my father to go to rehab because he'd been struggling with alcoholism and had tried on his own. He'd gone on the wagon for about 11 days. He was definitely trying. But as, you know, addiction and recovery being a lot more understood now, at least by myself than 25 years ago, you know, he was on the brink, but he really needed help. And so during that time, I went and asked my uncle if he would help, if we could try to get him into Betty Ford or somewhere to deal with this. Mm-hmm. And my uncle was ambivalent to the idea, just knowing how difficult it would be to convince my father, and said he'd never go willingly, and just left me with, well, I don't know what I'm going to do, but no matter what, we'll still be a family. And then 2 days later, he committed the fatal act.
Mm. And so your process of writing The Pornographer's Daughter helps process some of this. But what? Tell us a little bit about the earlier part of your life that is also a part of the play, of growing up around this industry. You call it a kind of child abuse, but did you realize? You probably didn't realize it then. How was it? How were you exposed to this industry as a child?
I mean, certainly it was passive exposure, because I would just be brought into the O'Farrell. We'd go up to the office, and there'd be pictures of naked women on the walls, or later on dancers walking around in their G-strings, and it was the family business.
And just saying, hi kiddo, how you doing?
Hi, you know, and it's not like they were sitting me down like, you have to watch this, and you know, I was being actively abused, but it's an understanding I didn't get until I was an adult, when I was doing a training for work, which involved child abuse, and you know, just said simply that exposure to pornography, exposing a minor to pornography, is a form of sexual abuse. And I just never thought of it in that context. I knew it was wrong and didn't feel right and inappropriate, but I kind of brushed off a lot of it. That was also, you know, being raised in the 70s in the Bay Area, a lot of us were exposed to a lot of very inappropriate things. And a lot of parents were, you know, were living on the edge. And it was our own kind of hippie version of benign neglect, and I was able to brush it off a lot, but it just gave me a context of realizing, okay, I wasn't, you know, I know my parents loved me, I know no one was trying to hurt me, but still, you know, what I witnessed really wasn't appropriate.
Right, right.
It wasn't explained, and, you know.
So this has helped you get through all this. How has it affected your siblings? Has this work that you've done helped them?
I don't know. I can't speak for all of them. I know my sister Mariah has been incredibly supportive of this work and has found it very cathartic personally. You know, and as we're saying, she was there last night, opening night. No one laughed harder, no one cried harder than she did. But she's with me all the way, which is invaluable, you know. And all of my siblings have given at least tacit support, and that no one has said, don't do this. But it's difficult. It's a for my family and for my cousins as well. It's, you know, we always had a lot of love in our family, but obviously my father's murder tore the family apart, and everyone was very young. I was 20. I was the oldest of the 10 Mitchell children. My youngest cousin was 5. And it was very hard to accept the fact that my uncle had actually murdered my dad, because they had always been so close and perceived as such, and it took a lot to process and let the truth of the situation filter up. And even so, there's still a lot of confusion. So I'm hopeful that this work ultimately will bring my family together and bring some relief, because it's written from a perspective of being a survivor and also as an adult finding compassion for the forerunners that the Mitchell brothers were, and that my parents were, you know, they were trying to do something different. And I was exposed to a lot of really remarkable, amazing experiences growing up in the Bay Area as a kid with artistic people. But, you know, becoming a parent definitely informed this piece for me, because it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's hard living a mainstream life. And I can't imagine, you know, having a couple little kids and then suddenly overnight becoming these porn icons with behind the green door and going to Cannes and becoming multimillionaires in really a blink of an eye. Like, that'd be a lot to handle. you know, so I kind of understand why things might have got a little cuckoo.
That's Liberty Bradford Mitchell, daughter of Artie Mitchell, whose show The Pornographer's Daughter is at Z Below through the, it's got running through
February 16th.
She's here with Michael T. Weiss, the director of the play. Michael, this is a story that is showing how Liberty's dealt with all this, but it's also an entertainment. So what's happening for the drama as we see this play unfold?
Well, I was very attracted to Liberty's Tale, not just because of the, you know, the saucy salaciousness of the headline rippingness of the story, but her very, very, very human story that we can all relate to, growing up in many different families, having to deal with tragedies. And Liberty's incredibly brave for getting up there and revealing herself like she does. But besides from the human, poignant, and really emotional story, we have a lot of fun. We have our band, The Fluffers.
I love the title.
Isn't that a great name?
That's a great
It's about
title.
Fluffernutter. Yeah, the Fluffers are great. We have some great video work by our lovely and talented Sky, who did the video stuff. It's just a really fun, enjoyable evening that will rip your heart out. And it's just beautiful and a whole lot of fun. And Liberty is so brave to get up there and tell us her story, which is a very human tale of trying to come into your own as a human being, as a sexual person, as a child of sexual revolutionaries. And not all of us have had that experience, so it's really interesting to see her side of that story.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about this, the how you compacted things down in The Pornographer's Daughter.
Well, that's why partially why I've been working on this piece since 1995 to to streamline and finally come to the story of The Pornographer's Daughter as it is today. And Michael's been with tremendous help in helping me really stay on the beam of just focusing on my story, my journey, and my truth, my experience. Because the Mitchell Brothers story is so huge. I mean, there's a million stories within their experience and the people that they've interacted with. But really, it's a family drama. It's a coming-of-age story. And we just did our best to simplify a story that has, you know, a lot of characters potentially, and it's been a really great distillation down, which I think that as a theater piece really serves it. And there's a poetry to it, and we really serve the emotion while as not getting too bogged down with the myriad details that could definitely just make this, it could be an 8-hour play if we wanted it to be, which we don't.
The Nicholas Nickleby of porn.
Yes. Exactly.
Well, we do have a pair of tickets for either Friday's or Saturday's 10:30 show if you're interested in seeing The Pornographer's Daughter. Give us a call here in studio at 841-412-4134. Get the number right. 415-841-4134 if you'd like a pair of tickets for either Friday or Saturday's show of The Pornographer's Daughter, starring Liberty Bradford Mitchell, directed by Michael T. Weiss at Z Below. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Well, thank you, David. It's been a pleasure.
Michael, I wish you a great run as well.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having us.
Shows are Thursdays at 8, Friday and Saturday at 8 and 10:30, and Sunday at 5 p.m. It's at Z Below, which is at 470 Florida Street in San Francisco. Tickets and information at www.pdtheplay.com. The Pornographer's Daughter, Liberty Bradford Mitchell. Stay with us. More with Brian Copeland and Matt Montgomery before the hour's out.
Thank you.
By happy coincidence, my producer Niels Swinkels, in celebration of Django Reinhardt's birthday, happened to bring in a cut, Ain't Misbehavin', rather appropriate to the conclusion of my talk with Liberty Mitchell and her The Pornographer's Daughter here on KALW. Good afternoon, I'm David LaTulipe. It is Open Air, our weekly program of most things culturally considered here on local public radio. Pleased to bring another wonderful radio personality to the airwaves here. Now in his fourth show, Brian Copeland is presenting The Scion, A Tale of Privilege, Murder, and Sausage, which kind of explores the role of privilege in government and regulation in modern society. On the comedy front, in addition to various clubs, Brian has been seen on NBC, A&E, MTV. Other initials include KTVU, breakfast program Mornings on 2, and for 2 years he hosted San Francisco ABC affiliate KGO's Emmy Award-winning afternoon talker 7 Live. His KGO radio show, The Brian Copeland Show, going strong 9 years in. Brian Copeland, an honor and a pleasure to welcome you to our airwaves.
Thank you. I should tell you, it's not 9 years. It's actually 20 years this year.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it'll be 20 years this summer. Be my 20th anniversary of doing the program on KGO.
Wow. So what's your show there all about?
Pretty much whatever it is, I feel like.
I listen to KLW myself.
It's a combination of news talk as well as interviews. I do a lot of cultural things. My third hour is kind of like a politically incorrect hour. I have comedians come in and we have some fun with the news of the week. So it's a fun and entertaining program in its 20th year.
And now with your next fourth solo show, The Scion. Tell us the plot of The Scion.
Well, here's what The Scion is about. Back in 2000, Stuart Alexander, who was the fourth generation owner of the Santos Linguisa factory in San Leandro, gunned down three USDA inspectors in cold blood, videotaped himself gunning them down. Because they wanted to inspect the factory and they were trying to shut him down, basically, because this is a guy who grew up thinking that the rules did not apply to him. So my first show, Not a Genuine Black Man, was about growing up in San Leandro as one of the few African Americans in the 70s. So I ran that show for years. In fact, it's coming back to Berkeley Rep this this April, and tickets are on sale for that at their website.
Before you go on, I want to mention that it has become the longest running solo play in San Francisco history.
Yeah, I ran 2.5 years there, ran 30 cities, off Broadway, Los Angeles. So that kind of made me an unofficial chronicler of San Leandro. So with this story, there was someone who knew Stuart Alexander, who had been after me for ages, saying that I needed to tell the story. I needed to talk about the story. And so after it harping on me for so long, I kind of looked into it. It was just fascinating because I used the title The Scion because that's how the media refers to the offspring of the aristocracy, the Kennedy Scion, the Rockefeller Scion, and so forth. Well, this is a guy who, because of his position, because of his name, because they were quote-unquote royalty in town, basically got away with everything his entire life, was never, ever, ever held accountable for anything. In fact, after he killed these three people, he literally thought he was just going to be in jail for a couple of weeks because people would understand. And he thought that where the regulation part comes in is he thought that the meat industry would back him because there's so many folks in the meat processing business who feel that they are harassed by inspectors. In fact, there was an article that ran back east under the story made national news. And there was an article that ran in a newspaper back east under the headline, "Good Man Who Felt Harassed, Accused of Gunning Down Three." And you had meat processors take this article, put it up in their factories and shops, and use it to intimidate inspectors when the inspectors came in. So this show is it's a combination of, the way I look at it is a combination of The Jungle meets In Cold Blood. It's really it. And it's a commentary. There's a lot of commentary on the role of privilege in society. The role of privilege, especially, I talk a lot about white privilege in this show and how we decide who is dangerous in this society. And I talk about the role of regulation. And even though it doesn't sound like it, it is a very funny show.
I was going to say, how do you get the comedy in with the tragedy there?
Well, that's, if you've seen any of my shows, all four of my shows, now that's what it is that I do. I go, it goes heavy, funny, heavy, funny, heavy, funny. I use the Norman Lear model. You know, he's was the master of that.
So you grew up with those. Well, yeah.
In fact, the first show, Genuine, I patterned directly after the rhythms of All in the Family. And the coolest thing was when I did the show in L.A. and Norman Lear came, and I said, he said he loved the show, and I said, well, I'm doing you. And he goes, oh, that's why I like it so much.
That's great. So I think what's the old phrase, never ask how sausages and something else.
It's laws and sausages. how laws and sausages are made. Exactly.
So I'm hoping the inspectors didn't end up in the mix.
Well, I'll tell you, even though I don't make this in the show, kind of like what Liberty was saying about her show could have been a billion pages. It's the same thing with this show. If I had put in every single nuance about this case, it would be, you know, a miniseries, basically. But that's one of the things that Stuart Alexander said to people, close people, during the time that he was having his run-ins with the inspectors, was that he'd kill him in the factory and put him through the sausage grinder and nobody would ever know. So, you know, it's pretty unbelievable, just the arrogance. And what you had here was a guy who the whole world enabled. That's really it. I mean, he did some horrific things, from beating up a senior citizen to hitting a guy in the head with a baseball bat to all kinds of just terrible things. And he was never, ever held accountable. So this is kind of things that, for example, you and I, if we did any of these things early on, we'd have gone to jail. You know, but because of who this guy was and because of privilege, it you know, he finally had to do something this egregious to be held accountable.
Hmm. Now, you mentioned that it's a distilling process, that it could go on for pages and pages.
Oh, sure.
You've been in preview since the 11th of this month, and it opens on February 1st.
Yeah.
What are you learning in the preview process?
Well, what I'm learning is that people really feel that there are things being said in this show that need to be said, things that nobody is really talking about. And, you know, I'm all over the place on this. I call out this phenomenon we have where the powerful are playing the victim now. You know, if you were someone who was middle class and you point out the disparity in wealth between rich and poor, you're engaging in class warfare. If you're a person of color and you point out the disparities in the justice system, then you're race baiting. If you agree with Warren Buffett when he says that he should pay a higher percentage of his income than his secretary does in taxes, then you hate job creators. I mean, it's really, really sick. And there, folks are really relating to this stuff because, you know, again, I'm calling out people on things that are not being said. I talk a lot about the Trayvon Martin case in this show. I was invited to do a lot of the Talking Head cable shows last summer. During that trial, I did Dr. Drew a number of times. I did Piers Morgan and so forth. And the discourse during this trial was just fascinating because, quite frankly, nobody said anything that really needed to be said. It was yelling and screaming and arguing and so on and so forth.
I'm wondering, this is a solo show.
Is
it a multi-character show?
Yes,
a la Margo Gomez, yes. And you know, you're putting on different hats and wigs and whatever.
Just like all of my shows, it's multi-character. Stuart Alexander does not appear in it. I made that David Ford, who directed and developed this with me, as he does with all my shows. We made a conscious decision that we were not going to glorify this guy by putting him in the show. It's people talking about him.
Oh, okay.
It's people who talk about him, and as I said, he videotaped these murders. He videotaped himself killing these inspectors because he thought that the tape would clear him to show that they had harassed him. That was his defense. He was harassed, driven, and driven to the murders by them. So I was actually able to view the murder tapes, which was a horrifying experience. And I talk about that in the show. I describe that in detail. So it's, I want to make it very clear, too, that this is not... it's not a 75-minute true crime story. You know, it's not the case does not cover this whole show. I talk about the case as a case study in examining these other issues.
Well, talk a little bit about David Ford and your relationship with him, how he works. You've been working with him for all of your shows.
Yeah, every single show. And
how does he mold you then?
It was just kind of a fluke the way that we even met in the very beginning. I had wanted to do a solo show for years, and I'd had this idea about, you know, writing about racial identity and what it means to be quote-unquote black in America. The way Genuine started, I got a letter at KGO from a listener who said, as an African-American, I'm disgusted every time I hear your voice because you were not a genuine black man. And that's where it came from. So I had this idea, and I had some things written. And I'm looking at the Chronicle one day, and I saw a review that was done by Stephen Wynn of a show by Bob Duback, where he gave it The Little Man Out of the Chair. And I'd never met Stephen Wynn. And I sent him an email, and I said, you know, I read your review. I want to do a one-man show. How do I do it? And he said, you need a director. And I said, "Who?" This is all back and forth email. And he says, the two best in town are David Dower at Z-Space and David Ford at The Marsh. So I sent them both emails, and the subject line was "Help" in capital letters with exclamation points. David Dower never got back to me. David Ford did. So the first day we met, I told him my idea. I said, "What's your play about?" And I said, "It's about racism, housing discrimination, and suicidal depression." He goes, "I don't think this has ever been done before."
And you're just the guy.
And you're just the guy. And we put this thing together, and it was supposed to run for 6 weeks. And I thought I'd do it. My 6 weeks, I'd be done, and that would be it. And it just exploded and ran for over 700 performances to date.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, you're reprising this in April.
Yes.
What are the challenges of revisiting a show like that? And have you made changes?
There have been some changes in the very beginning because it starts out with about 5 minutes of almost of stand-up about what's black and what's not. And there are some references that were in the original version that just don't work today. And there are some references now that are changed to include the Obama presidency and so forth. The biggest challenge is that when you do a show for a long time, there are a lot of nuances that you develop. You know that if you say a line a specific way, you can get a specific reaction from the audience. And those are things that you forget or things that you lose when you haven't done it for a while.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you're starting this with some stand-up. You mentioned earlier that a role model was Norman Lear in terms of your style. Who else did you have as comedic role models?
Oh, comedic role. All kind. I started in stand-up at 18 years old. I started
4 years ago. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, my idols in stand-up, Jack Benny. I just was just the master of timing. And Jack Benny, I listen to Jack Benny radio shows, and it still makes me laugh. He still cracks me up.
Well,
now cut that out, Reed. Now Dennis
Rochester.
It was Pryor. It was seeing Pryor's. What made me decide to go on stage for the first time is I was 17, and on HBO they showed Pryor's first film, his first stand-up film that was done in Long Beach, and I'd never seen anything like it before. He talked about his heart attack, he talked about being addicted to cocaine, he talked about his father dying, all of this stuff that I'd never heard anybody, all the stuff that was so real that I'd never heard anyone discuss before, and talk about it in a way that was just so funny. And that's when I thought, wow, I have to try this.
I should mention that my predecessor here as host of Open Air, Alan Farley, was a road manager for Pryor for a number of years.
Really? Yeah. Wow. I'll bet he's got stories to tell.
Oh, believe me. some that will would turn your complexion, let's say, either white or flush it. I don't have to be polite about that. Now, you struggled with depression like so many comedians.
Yeah.
How has this affected your work?
Well, my second show, The Waiting Period, was about depression. I touch on it in Genuine, and there were a lot of folks who'd said, yeah, I wish you would go deeper into that. So I did a whole show about it, and it was about a really bad suicidal bout I had back in 2008 where I'd actually purchased a gun. And what The Waiting Period is the 10-day wait in California between the time you buy and the time that you can get it. Time you can pick it up, and it's what I went through, as well as I do characters of other sufferers. There's a girl who's a cutter. There is a firefighter who has PTSD and doesn't realize he's dealing with it, and a high school girl. All different folks who deal with various aspects of it. And the point of that show was just to get people to talk. Because depression is the last stigmatized disease in America. You know, people are ashamed of being depressed. You wouldn't be ashamed if you had cancer or if you had Lou Gehrig's disease. But for some reason, people who have depression, suffer from it, are afraid to talk about it. And if they're having suicidal thoughts, they don't tell anybody. The really cool thing about that show is because at the end of it, I tell people, if I can stand up here and spill my guts to strangers for an hour, you can tell somebody if you're having thoughts that aren't in your best interest. And I get emails.
And prevent you from spilling your guts.
Exactly.
Literally.
I get emails all the time from people who were there, and they told somebody, or they went and got help, or family members who just didn't understand why you can't just say, hey, the sun's shining, perk up. and now they have a better understanding.
Interesting. That's Brian Copeland. He's starring in the world premiere of The Scion at the Marsh, A Tale of Privilege, Murder, and Sausage. We do have five pairs of tickets that we're offering for tomorrow evening's performance. Is that correct? For tomorrow evening or Saturday?
You know what? Let's do it for tonight.
For tonight. Tonight's performance.
Tonight at 8.
Of The Scion at 8 o'clock. We have five pairs of tickets. If you call us here in studio, 841-4134. That number, 415-841-4134, to see Brian Copeland's fourth solo show at The Marsh, The Scion. Now, Brian, as a radio host, you've been called the Black Howard Stern. Now, is that a compliment or not?
Was that a joke?
That
was one radio columnist ages ago referred to me that just in terms of going... pushing the limits and going to the line in terms of some of the things that I've done on the air.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about, as a non-KGO listener, when can we see hear your show?
It's Sunday afternoons.
Sunday afternoons, 1 to 4. 1 on KGO.
Yeah, for years I was on Sunday morning. About 2 years ago, they moved me to afternoon so I can sleep in, which is nice. I'm usually doing performances on Saturday night, and, you know, having to get up at 4 or 5 a.m. on Sundays was... you shouldn't be up at 4 a.m. on a Sunday unless you have a bear claw and a fishing pole.
I'm with you on that, except for the fishing pole part. So do you have a team that helps you coordinate guests as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've got a terrific couple of producers who work on the program, helping me to pick topics as well as booking guests.
Mm-hmm. The Scion is running through through March 1st.
Yeah, opening night. These are previews right now. Opening night is February 1st. We're making nips and tucks based on what how the audience responds to things, and they've been wonderful. They've just been wonderful crowds so far.
It's at The Marsh. Information at themarsh.org. Brian Copeland, fourth solo show, The Scion, after which stay tuned for a reprise of Not a Genuine Black Man later this year.
April 23rd through May. And again, tickets are on sale right now for that. You can go to berkeleyrep.org, or you can go to my website for links to both at briancopeland.com.
On all things Brian Copeland.
All things. All things.
Brian, thanks for taking some time today.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Of course.
Activation, desolation, take a good look around. Simple pleasures, no pressure, all it takes is a sound. So take a listen, uncover your ears, petty troubles will soon disappear. Eyebrows raising, embracing all the fates that arise. Choices, no voices, all it takes to decide. So leave a message after the tone, 'cause I don't know when again I'll be home. Take a listen and cover your ears, and petty troubles will soon disappear. Sometimes it seems that everybody's waiting to go up. Don't be afraid to explain that you're not listening, but in your dreams it's never so unlikely for you to succeed.
Just a taste of Petty Troubles by my next guest, Matt Martin. Here to talk about a concert this Sunday afternoon, January 26th, at Alice Center for the Arts, celebrating a CD and DV documentary of Matt's project, Petty Troubles. It's a series of Matt's new songs orchestrated by Brian McCune and accompanied by the Awesome Orchestra. Great title for an orchestra, and great to have Matt Montgomery here to tell us about it. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Sure, welcome to the airwaves here, and I look forward to Sunday's performance. Now, it's also going to be, well, tell us about what we're going to hear on Sunday afternoon.
Well, we're going to have a full orchestra, and we're going to perform the album we recorded back in May all the way through. Awesome Orchestra is going to be joining us. They're fronted by Dave Meschler. They just did the stand show at the Independent for 3 sold-out nights, Undercover Presents. And funny enough, opening the show is Van Dyke Parks, who's just an idol of mine, and I'm thrilled to have him on. And
well, Van Dyke's been involved in so many great groups, collaborated with Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys, Randy Newman, the Byrds, Ringo Starr, and Marley's guy. It's just
an amazing
character. What's he got in stall for starting things off?
Well, he's taking advantage of the full orchestra we're going to have. He's going to be playing tunes off of Jump and Moonlighting at the Ash Grove. And yeah, we're going to rehearse the day of and put on a show in the afternoon, and should be a good time.
All right, let's talk about the CD then. We're going to hear it in its full on Sunday, but what's on the CD?
Well, there are 5 songs that I've written over the last few years, and my good friend Brian Adam McCune orchestrated. And I think the interesting thing about the album is it has 28 performers, and we recorded it live in one day.
Oh my gosh.
So we all got together in a big warehouse in Oakland and ran through the tunes, hit some spots, did 1 or 2 takes of each tune, and at the end of the day we had a record.
Petty Troubles, is that the theme for the rest of the tunes, or what's the inspiration for some of the other tunes you'll hear?
I don't know the answer to the question of why do I write songs. They just kind of come to me, pour out of me. I don't know what else to do with my time.
Oh, good for you. I see, it's funny. People have that creative edge of creation where I'm more of an interpreter. You know, mm-hmm. Give me something on the page, I'll nail it. I don't have an original thought in my head when it comes to music, so it's more power to you to get something new. And when you think about it, how much you can create with just the 12 tones of Western music.
Yeah. They're all songs that, you know, I just played either on a piano or an ukulele for friends, and but I had grand visions of orchestral accompaniment for a long time. And then when I met Brian McCune and started to get to know people in Awesome Orchestra and Classical Revolution and all the amazing classical players that are in the Bay Area, the idea just kind of formed.
So Brian being the orchestrator,
mm-hmm.
He's kind of the Ferdy Groffet to your George Gershwin then.
Yeah, I think that's a good analogy there.
So Petty Troubles we heard a little bit of. What are the other tracks?
We've got a song, On Top of the World, which I get to kind of do my Brian May guitar style solo over the top of an orchestra, which was so much fun. And it's actually featured in a video game called Rocksmith 2014, which I work on as my day job. So one of the coolest things is seeing people from all over the world playing along to the song with the game and posting it on YouTube.
And, oh, cool.
Yeah, it's really fun.
Uh-huh. And the other tunes?
Let's see. We've got a song, Though I Try, which is kind of a more bluesy number, kind of a theme of frustration, I think, with that song. And then 1,000 Years is probably the most grandiose of them, just big French horns, and I think the song clocks in at 5.5 minutes and is the epic number, and close off with really kind of a lullaby type song called Wishing on a Fallen Star, which I think is the prettiest song on the record.
I think I've heard that. It's a nice tune.
Oh,
congratulations. The multi-talented Matt Montgomery, also a fiddle player, ukulele, guitar, singer, beautiful singing voice. On Sunday afternoon, January 26th, this Sunday, Alice Center for the Arts on Alice Street in Oakland.
It's actually called the Malanga Casquillord Center for the Arts. It's formerly known as the Alice Arts Center.
Okay, it's on Alice Street in Oakland. Doors open at 3:30 with the concert at 4. Some beer and goodies to follow.
That's, oh, yeah.
And special guest star Van Dyke Parks is part of the mix, the legendary composer, orchestrator, lyricist, and producer who's worked with everyone from the Beach Boys to Marley's Ghost. You can get information at pettytroubles.com. We also have 5 pairs of tickets that we're going to offer for listeners. This is a ticket giveaway Thursday here on KALW. 415-841-4134 if you'd like to see Matt and his gang in the Awesome Orchestra in Oakland on Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock, Matt Montgomery and Company. Matt, we're going to hear one more tune from your CD, the first track. Tell us about it.
Oh, it was the song On Top of the World that features a lot of guitar and definitely very Beatles-inspired and maybe the most upbeat song on the record, and Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Cool. Top of the World, Matt Montgomery and the Awesome Orchestra, which you can hear this Sunday. You can get some tickets to see them on Sunday at the Milonga Center, formerly the Alice Center, on Alice Street in Oakland. That's a 4 o'clock concert. 415-841-4134 if you'd like a ticket or two to that Sunday performance. And let's go out with some more music of Matt Montgomery and Top of the World. Matt, thanks for taking a little bit of time today. Maybe we can have you in live next time.
I'd love it. Thanks so much for having me.
Of time, we've waited here for so long. Bags have been packed. Take one look back, smile and wave a goodbye. It's yours, it's mine. The weather is fine. So take a step to the sky. So pretty and white, dazzles my sight. It's been that way all along. Friends are all here, their love's so near. Voices burst out in song. It's yours, it's mine. The weather is fine. So take a step to the sky.
Of Matt Montgomery can be heard this Sunday afternoon, January 26th. Information at pettytroubles.com. I'm David Lotulip. That's Open Air for this week. My thanks, as always, to producer Neil Swinkles for orchestrating today's parade of guests. Shows can be heard at our website, kalw.org. Going out with the music of Django Reinhardt, Birthday Boy, 1910 to 1953. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that Django. Join us next week. This is KALW San Francisco.